From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on a historic election night for the grand old party. Republicans today might not look and sound much like Reagan did in 1984, but it's been 40 years since the party had quite a night as dominant. Donald Trump swept all seven battleground states, Republicans took control of the U.S. Senate, and Republicans look like they might be able to retain control of the House, giving the incoming Trump White House full control of all branches there. Here in New York State, there were few surprises, with incumbents doing very well in our region. But here's one change. New York City's five boroughs collectively moved 10 points further to the right. Kamala Harris won the smallest percentage of New York City for a Democratic presidential candidate since 1988. Republicans are starting to dream of turning New York purple or even red. We're going to talk to winners and party leaders these 2 hours. My first guest has been reelected to the New York State Assembly. Josh Jensen's going back to the Assembly in District number 134. Assemblyman Jensen, welcome back to the program. Have you slept at all?
Thank you, Evan. Happy to be back. And I got a little bit of sleep between about 3 a.m. and 7 a.m. So, well, not quite well rested, but full of caffeine.
What's the story to you from election night?
I mean, I think certainly, obviously, at any presidential election year, it's going to be the very top of the ticket, and President Trump winning the White House back, and certainly looking like there's going to be full Republican control of the federal government. I think that's going to really show a different direction in our federal government. But in New York State, you know, in the level of government where I serve, it's almost the status quo in the opposite way. Certainly, we're, you know, one party control by the Democrats. You know, we unfortunately in the Assembly, we the Republican Party, we lost one seat, so we're now a 47 seat super minority. So, I think even more importantly for me, making sure that we remain a strong voice of opposition and common sense, and asking questions and demanding accountability from New York State government.
Well, Assemblyman, I want to talk to you a little bit about the future of politics in the state. There's a gubernatorial election in a couple of years, and you know, I take the point that you make about the current dynamics, but Kamala Harris wins this state by 10.5 points. It looks like not 20, yeah. Not 25, and New York City's boroughs go 10 points collectively further to the right. A big shift. And that is across a lot of different demographics. You know, the political left cannot spin a narrative that this is, well, you know, the Republican Party is white men. It is a much more multicultural coalition this morning. And so is there a thought in your party that where you are going could accelerate in this direction, that you could win the governor's office in 2 years, that you could really start to erode majorities and get close to in the near term something like a majority in the legislature?
I mean, I think so. I think, you know, if you take a lesson from anything that happened at the federal level, there was a lot of challengers who took office, who won, who talked about the issues that families are most concerned about. And those are things about affordability and public safety. And those resonated, like you said, with people across cultural dynamics. And I think, especially in a state in the last night where, you know, Donald Trump won 45% of the vote in New York, but yet didn't really quite have the drag along other Republicans, where we lost, I think, five targeted congressional seats. I think it shows that, you know, we have to talk about the things that people truly care about and the things that are most directly affecting their life at the moment, because I think a lot of people are voting based on that personal interest about, okay, who can best serve the needs that I have today? And I think that's what public service of both parties are really going to be looking at over the next 12, 24 months.
Who is likely to be the GOP's gubernatorial candidate in 2 years?
Well, that's the $20 million question. Certainly, I think there's going to be some strong candidates, but it'll be interesting to see. You know, there's a lot of New Yorkers who serve in office who may be part of Donald Trump's administration. So I think there's a lot of it. A lot of things still up in the air. I know that I was very happy to see my good friend Mike Lawler get reelected to Congress down in the Hudson Valley. So I'm looking forward to seeing his continued leadership for New York in Congress. But I think there'll be contenders, and it'll be interesting to see how the situation evolves over the next year.
There's a lot of reasons that what happened yesterday happened at a lot of different levels in politics. And so there's not any one pat explanation. Certainly, if you look around the world, when inflation has happened, incumbent politicians around the world in democratic societies have lost. And that happened yesterday. But it is a little bit more complex than that, I think. And I want to ask you why you think the Republican Party, not just at the top of the ticket, but why the Republican Party had such a good day yesterday. And what do you think maybe has been misread on the other side of the political aisle?
Well, I think you mentioned it a few minutes ago, and I think it's, you know, looking at the electorate not based on, you know, the gender of voters or the race of voters or ethnicity of voters, but saying what are the issues that people are really caring about? Because affordability matters for every race. It matters for every religion, and it matters for every political party. And I think that's I think public servants and those in elected office, I think sometimes overlooked that to a degree and kind of look at more existential questions instead of thinking about, okay, are people voting with their bank account? Are people voting based on the interest of, you know, when they go into to Wegmans to buy, you know, a pound of apples? It's, I think that's what, you know, we have to take more of an interest in, because that's what people are voting for when they walk in. Who's going to best represent them and put them in a society that makes them comfortable and being able to live in household income? That's usually one of the biggest drivers of that.
Well, before I let you go, Assembly Member, when you were on this program during the campaign, we talked a little bit about how you see the definition of conservatism, and we talked about incrementalism versus maximalism, and the conservative ethos that says, you know, you don't burn it all down, you make steps carefully, wisely, you conserve and preserve a lot of tradition and history, and move forward, without being rash. And, you know, the new administration at the top, RFK, just told NPR this morning he thinks by January 20th we could be banning fluoride. We're going to see brand new rules with vaccines in schools. He wants to slash the FDA. J.D. Vance wrote the foreword for a book titled Burn It Down. That does not sound like incrementalism to me, and I wonder how you feel about some of that rhetoric and what you think is going to happen on the national level.
I mean, I don't agree with all that rhetoric and certainly all the positions that are being taken by the individuals you mentioned. But I also think that we don't live necessarily in a republic where the president, no matter who they are, can unilaterally do everything. They're still going to have to work with a Senate that still does not have a filibuster-proof majority, still a very closely contested House of Representatives that, you know, one party is not going to have more than a 10-seat majority. So, you know, you have the Republican Party, if it is in the majority in both houses, is still a big tent party where you have people who are very conservative to moderate Republicans. And I think that President Trump and his administration, whoever he names to his cabinet, is going to have to understand that they are governing the entire country, where you have a very divergent view of the way government should operate. And the idea of that incrementalism, where we can make those improvements, we can make things more efficient, but, you know, we need to do it in a way that protects all Americans, not necessarily just one group of voters.
Assembly Member Josh Jensen in District Number 134 is going back to the New York State Assembly. Congratulations to you and the party today. Thank you for making the time. You've always been one of the most accessible leaders, and I always enjoyed the conversation. Look forward to the next one.
Yeah, my pleasure, Evan. I want to thank the 48,000 people in Greece, Ogden, Parma, who chose to put their faith in me for another 2 years.
That's Josh Jensen, member of the New York State Assembly, and we thank him for his time. Listeners, we are spending these 2 hours with the winners, with the party leaders, and trying to take stock of what happened, obviously, here in our region. And I know on a lot of listeners' minds is what's happening across the country. Our next guest is the chair of the Monroe County Democrats. Stephen DeVay is on the line with us, and I wonder, Mr. Chairman, if you've gotten much sleep and how you're doing this morning, this afternoon. My goodness, it's the afternoon. Hello. Go ahead, Stephen.
Good afternoon. I've gotten a little bit of sleep and I'm doing what I think a lot of people are doing right now, which is just refreshing various sites.
Well, sure. And let me start with the kind of the national view, and then we're going to kind of come local and spend a lot of time in the local races here. But when you look at the national election, I can't imagine that it turned out exactly like you expected. And Democrats are going to spend a lot of time trying to figure out what happened and why. I'm not looking for a quick one-sentence explanation. I think it's more complicated than that. But can you, at this point, formulate some ideas as to how we got here for your party?
Yeah, I think that you saying that we're not going to formulate this down to one sentence is absolutely on point. We're looking at things, and there isn't a way to break this down into one sentence or one thing that we're going to do. What we know is that there is a messaging thing that has to break through. I believe we broke through with that messaging here in Monroe County. I believe that when we talked about the issues, when we talked about what families are facing, when we talk about what individuals were going to that voting booth and thinking about and worried about, we broke through with that. It's clear that we did not do that at the national level.
What do you think your party has misread about the electorate or about what is moving people to vote?
I don't know that I'm ready to say what we've misread. I think there's going to be a lot of reflection that's going to happen over the next few days. What I do think is that we here have heard what the people in Parrington, Pittsburgh, Greece, et cetera, are all feeling and what they need. We've delivered on that, and we're going to continue to deliver on that in this era where we're going to have to continue to fight every single day for the things that we need.
We'll get back to the national stuff in a moment, but when you do look at state races, local races, there weren't big upsets. Incumbents did very well. We're going to be talking this hour to Sarah Clark, Sommer Brook. They won resounding re-elections. Next hour, we're going to talk to Joe Morelli. We're going to talk to DeMond Meeks. I mean, Democrats do have a lot to celebrate in that way. Prop 1 won a resounding victory. So, if you were to look at the night in that lens, what are the lessons that you're taking from those races?
I think especially let's look at Prop 1. Prop 1 didn't just pass because of New York City. It didn't just pass because of the, dense areas in our state. It passed right here in Monroe County. And so we look at situations like that. We know through people voting directly for their rights that this is what they're focused on. This is what they care about. We know that here in Monroe County, and we're going to continue to fight. We're going to continue to do the things that we have to do right here. And that includes sending our entire state delegation back to Albany to fight for us. And it includes sending Joe Morelli back to Congress in order to be one of those lines of defense that we need as we're continuing on in Washington and Albany.
Talking to Stephen DeVay, chair of the Democrats. So with New York State in the position it's in, we just talked to Josh Jensen, a Republican, and he acknowledged he's up against a supermajority in the legislature. Democrats still retain control. But if you look at the boroughs in New York City, 10 points further to the right, Kamala Harris wins the smallest share of New York City for a Democrat since 1988. Kamala Harris wins by 10 to 11 points in the state, not 25. And Republicans are starting to talk about turning the state purple. I mean, are you realistically concerned about that?
I'm not. I think when I look at the things that the voter base cares about, what people care about when they're talking at their, kitchen table and when they're talking at their dinner table, they're concerned and they're caring about the issues that Democrats are fighting for. We're the ones right now that are going into the assembly. We're going into the state Senate. We're going in there and fighting for the things that we need. And I think that's what people are focused on. And I think we saw that in some of the results last night here in Monroe.
Is it too early to start looking ahead in 2026 and assuming that Governor Hochul might run for re-election? Do you think the party is going to shake things up?
I think it might be a little bit early to be looking ahead in that direction. But what I again, do know is I think that here we did the things that needed to be done. We know that the Democratic Party here in New York State and in Monroe County is strong. We passed the things that we needed to do. We did the work that we needed to do. We fought for those swing districts the way that we needed to do. And I look forward to doing that again if we have to.
Well, so let me just continue on this theme for a couple more minutes, and then we'll let Stephen go. I know he's tired, and everyone who is giving us their time on this program today is very generous with that. Stephen is the chair of the Monroe County Democrats. You talk about a party making tough decisions, doing what it needs to do. And, if you look at the decision in July that President Biden made not to run for re-election, that came after intense internal party pressure and probably would not have been made without it. There's certainly an argument that that pressure came too late, or that that decision was only part of what needed to happen, which was to create a situation where Democrats could nominate someone who wasn't the president or the vice president, given inflation, given the many headwinds against the incumbent ticket there. Do you look at what happened at that national level and think that that is or is not an example of the party doing what it needed to do?
I think as I look nationally, we have to have a real conversation about what we're doing to message and break into the areas that we are really fighting for. I think that nationally we're seeing that people needed to hear more about the work that Democrats are doing, the fight that we're doing, the bills that we're passing, the work that we're doing on behalf of our families. That needed to break through a little bit more on the national level. You know, again, I am the county chair, so I'll break into the county level
absolutely.
A little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
But we broke through that here, right? People heard that. We didn't just win last night by a couple points. We broke through. We absolutely had that message out there about the work that we were doing on behalf of families, on behalf of our, you know, if I'm looking individually, on behalf of aunts and uncles and cousins and everything else. We broke through that. I do think there needs to be that conversation to figure out how do we bring that message? How do we bring this fight into a broader scale? Because we're doing it here in Monroe. I'm really proud to be doing it here in Monroe, but I think it's clear that we have to figure out how to break through that at the national level.
And let me also talk to you a little bit about coalition building, which you have done a lot of work on. The party's done a lot of work on. I think undoubtedly Democrats would say locally that's why your party outperformed Democrats at a national level last night, and that's why you were so successful yesterday. When you look at some of the early data, and I think it's pretty good data now. I mean, I'm sure there will be some shift here. But for the first time ever, a Republican presidential candidate wins Latino men outright. And the Latino gap is single digits. It is a 20 to 30 point shift in just 4 to 8 years. Donald Trump in early exit polling wins just over 1 in 5 people who identify as LGBTQ. Donald Trump in the state of Michigan wins Muslims. Donald Trump is doing much better in this election with black men than with 4 and 8 years ago. He did better demographically in just about every category after 4 to 8 years of campaigns to say he is bigoted, he can't be trusted, he doesn't care about you. Well, he built those coalitions. He lost women pretty handily, and he lost people with college degrees pretty handily. Otherwise, the GOP gained just about everywhere. You have built coalitions pretty successfully here. Why is it working here, but on the national level, that coalition building is going the Republicans' way? What do you see there, and what do you want to see happen in the years to come for your party?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we've done locally here, so just recently we announced the formation of the MCDC Women's Caucus and the Equity Caucus. We're really proud to be announcing the formation of the Latino Caucus coming soon, the APETA Caucus. We're going to start continuing to engage in these communities that, if I'm being honest, they haven't felt like they've had a voice at the table in what we've been building. We're following the model of the state Democrats here who have these various caucuses that are allowing people not just to be, you know, transparently, not just to be tokens that are there representing themselves, but to really have the ability to form these coalitions, to bring people in, to say, this is what this big tent party looks like. This is what this big tent party is. We're building that here, and we're going to continue to do it. I think that we're seeing those victories here because of that work, because of the work to make sure that we pass Prop 1, because of the work to make sure that women have a seat at the table, the APETA community, Latinos, black men, everybody is having a seat at this table here in Monroe County. And I do think we're going to have that conversation nationwide about how do we do that? How do we make sure that it's not just that they're there because we know they're supposed to be there, but how do we make sure they're there with that loud, strong voice that we know those communities have? Because we've been, frankly, we've been ignoring it a little bit too long. And we know we need to do more to do that. And we're really proud to do that here. And we're proud to do that at the state level.
Well, and in states like Michigan, the Republicans won male voters 18 to 29 outright. And so When you look at young men, I mean, one of my conclusions, and this is everyone's sort of going on half information, and maybe we'll change some of these ideas going forward, but I think a lot of people looked at January 6th and thought, well, that's the end of Donald Trump's political career. And a lot of men, particularly young men, looked at that and kind of thought it was, to use the term they would use, it was kind of badass. It was, it was anti-establishment. It was tough. It did not sink him essentially at all. And it might have been a plus with young men. So a lot of young men told pollsters that they felt ignored in the economy, that they felt adrift and shut out by Democrats. So before I let you go here, what's the outreach to young men going to be, and what is the appeal that you want the Democratic Party to have to young men?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good point. And it's one of those areas that, obviously, looking at the national results, we know that we need to do a little bit more of in reaching out. You know, the hard part is there is an aspect of the work that we do that isn't fighting for a month or a week or, you know, even months to say, this is what we're going to do. The work that we're doing takes time. You know, the arc of justice bends slowly sometimes. And so we know the work that we have to do is us pulling up our sleeves, us digging in, us doing the work that needs to be done to make sure that our rights are defended. And that can be a lot of effort. That can be a lot of tireless nights, a lot of, you know, getting around the table talking about these things. And that's one of the messages that I think that we have to figure out, is that this stuff isn't going to happen quickly. This isn't going to happen overnight. That's what was promised to them. I think that's what they lean into a lot. But if we really, really look at what we have to do here at the county level, the state level, and across this nation, we've got to figure out how to message the fact that people are going to have to really, really dig in deep and roll up their sleeves and get to work here now.
Stephen, thank you for making the time. I look forward to having a chance to sit down in studio with you when everyone's sort of decompressed and there's a lot more to talk about soon. But thank you for making the time today.
Of course. I'd be happy to come on in, Adam.
Stephen DeVay is the chair of the Monroe County Democrats, and as you just heard, they had a lot of success last night. It's a hard day for Democrats across the country, but the party here did very well. Incumbents didn't just win, they dominated. And that's true for the Republican incumbents who were on tickets. It was a good night for incumbents in our region, but Democrats here didn't see the slippage and the struggle that happened in a lot of places last night. So talking to Chairman DeVay, not only about that, but his views on what did happen nationally and where everyone in his party goes next. Well, on that note, my next guest is one of those dominant victors from election night. Member of the New York State Assembly, Sarah Clark, is with us. She is going back to district number 136 and won essentially a 2-1 victory, 63-31 in her race. Assemblymember Clark, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Everyone is sort of tired and a little delirious. And has a lot of different emotions. How are you feel? This has got to be a strange day. I mean, you win a dominant reelection. That has to feel good. Then you look at the national party, I suspect, as a Democrat, that can't feel good. How are you feeling today?
I feel a little more numb. I mean, I have a lot of PTSD from 2016. So, you know, we were actually in New York City then with the former Hillary Clinton team and folks, you know, helped a lot on that campaign trail. So I feel like I have a lot of PTSD, which has just kind of made me a little numb, and it's all sinking in right now. So I think I will have a lot more to say in the next few days and weeks. But I think it has shown me a lot about, you know, here locally, about what we've been able to do, both as a coalition, as a state delegation, but also as just good representatives that, you know, listen to our constituents, that, you know, try to make government work a little better for everyone, and make policy work better for everyone. And I feel like that has really resonated, and I think we're seeing the effects of that. So that makes me feel good, but it, you know, we have a lot of work to do, and there is a lot of, you know, a lot of, I don't want to say fear, but there's an unknown of what these next 4 years are going to be like, given what we lived through from 2016 to 2020. And so a lot of just a little nervous about it all.
Well, I'm looking at these numbers here, and if local Democrats had had a night that mirrored what happened in a lot of places in this country. Your victory, you might still win, of course. 63-31 is what you won. That's the numbers I see. I don't know if that's exactly right. But, you know, maybe you squeak by. Maybe it gets close to single digits. Maybe a lot of those margins get eroded. It didn't happen here. It did for the party nationally. Why do you think locally Democrats did so much better than a lot of Democrats did nationally?
It's hard to say. I mean, one of the things that I find on the national level is that people vote a lot on their how they're feeling about things, right? Whether or not they it's so strength and their perception of that I'm going to figure it out, I'm going to make you feel safe in your community, I'm going to solve this complex issue. I can't tell you how. I don't have a plan yet, but you know I will. But it just makes you feel better when you come from this place of strength. I think you know some of your earlier comments on even January 6th, right? I do think that there are people that see that as a standing up for yourself kind of thing, or feeling, you know, someone who feels that they have power to do things. And when you are struggling in your life, your family's life is harder, and you feel that there's someone out there that just is telling you they're going to be able to fix it and make it better. You know, I think there's a lot of people that go that way. But what we've done here, which is harder and takes more time, but is really spending those times in those weeds to feel, you know, not just to come in and say, this is what we're going to do, but really listen to what people say they need and want and then go turn around and try to fight for it. And so I think it is something to do with just making sure people feel heard and people feel that you're listening to them and their position in life, that what they're struggling with or what their priorities are.
Did you go into Election Day thinking that Kamala Harris would win the national election?
I did.
Yeah,
I mean, I was very hopeful. It might have been just my overwhelming optimism that I live with every day, but I just thought this was going to be different. You know, I think when Hillary ran in 2016, she ran as the first woman president to run, and it was a lot of some backlash against that. And I thought Kamala kind of created a path that really was joyous and full of hope and light. And I thought she ran a great ground game and, you know, all the things we saw of how you run campaigns. I just felt a lot more optimistic and yeah, it was pretty hard to watch it all.
What surprised you the most?
How overwhelming it is. You know, I think even what we were hearing, even if it feels anecdotal, I mean, you look at it's a complete revamp of the GOP, right? This is not the party of George W. Bush or Mitt Romney or Paul Ryan or any of the, you know, original sort of folks of my time when I worked in the Senate and sort of lived through the last 20 years. I mean, it's a completely different party, and they just, you know, they didn't win with the better ground game. They didn't win. They just sort of won on this, you know, identifying people's feelings and trying to figure out a way to make sure they came across as the one who could figure it out and solve it. And it worked. It's just really, you know, and I obviously we have a lot of work. I've always said we've had a lot of work to do in our rural areas, in our, you know, young men. We're seeing it now in our immigration populations, our first generation, second generation here who are not just, you know, coming into the Democratic Party as easily as they have in the past and saying they have different kinds of issues. And we need to relate and catch up and make sure we're on message about our values and what we really see is important and hope that it can resonate in the ways that we've kind of helped make things resonate here in Rochester.
Well, it's definitely true that the 2024 Republican Party is very, very different than the 2004 and especially the 1984 Republican Party. You know, I kind of always get confused when I hear people say, you know, I would, my hero is Ronald Reagan. That's why I'm voting for Trump. And it was like, they're not the same at all. I mean, like
No.
So much has changed, but
yeah.
This is a party that had the kind of night that validates a lot of where they have moved to in their minds. And so,
right.
In rural America, which is landslide GOP now. Just when you thought Trump couldn't gain anymore in rural America, he did. So what's your pitch? Assemblymember Clark, if you go to, you know, a very Republican household in rural New York and rural America, and they say, well, what's the pitch? Why would I vote for a Democrat? What are you saying to people in rural America?
Well, we have to figure out first. I mean, I think the messaging that's been really resonating from the GOP side is I can tell you who to blame for it. And then, you know, I think we can figure it out from there. We'll just get rid of that group, that person, that whatever. And your life will get better and everything will be fine. And I think it's right. We can either message into people's fear or we can try to message into people's hope. And that really takes understanding what people want. I mean, most of our rural America has seen their main streets close down and not a lot of revitalization or investment. We've seen farms consolidate. We don't have the strength of the numerous small family farms anymore in the places that really created economic opportunity for people in a way that was empowering and not reliant on sort of super mega conglomerates. But it's hard, right? So it's hard to say, you know, do you want to go back to that or do you have a vision for your community, your town, and what does it involve? And some of the things are the same, right? Like affording childcare, affording higher education. I always talk about my grandpa who was a dairy processor. He was able to send three kids to college as a guy who, you know, ran a dairy. That's just not feasible anymore. We've made it really hard for our families economically to just get what we consider the American dream. I just think we're blaming the wrong people. When you hear that 42% of single family homes in the next 10 years are going to be owned by private equity firms and nobody's raising the red flag that we, you know, overwhelmingly elected a corporate billionaire who wants to bring in all his corporate billionaire folks who run private equity firms. I mean, that to me is terrifying.
You mentioned young men as well. And young men, this was a huge swing for Donald Trump and Republicans. 18 to 29, two things happen. Number one, 18, 29-year-old men went Republican in a big, big swing, like a 30-point swing. And the second thing is they did show up to vote. That is a classification. Now, maybe not as much as 65-plus, but there's always this assumption that, well, women will vote more than men reliably, and the younger the cohort, the less they come out. Well, they came out. And they say that they have felt ignored by the Democrats or that they're often told that they're all toxic, that the podcasts that they listen to, the Joe Rogans of the world are telling them, you know, that they have been treated very badly by the cultural left. What's the outreach to young men going to be for Democrats? How do you win them back?
Oh, as the mom of two of them, you know, these are questions that we have to ask. And I see what they consume and what their friends watch and that we have to get ahead of it. I mean, it's this constant, you know, people are, when I knock on doors and they're like, oh, I don't want to talk about pronouns or I have an issue with this. And that's all you guys talk about. I'm like, that's not all we talk about. It's what people who don't want those things, don't want people to have the freedom and individuality to be who they are talking about it because it's an issue that drives division. And we have to figure out a way ahead of it. And we have to figure out a way to ensure that people, that this isn't a pie that shrinks. This is a pie that grows when everyone's involved. The success of our country is when we lean into our vibrancy and our diversity and make everybody will succeed. But instead, if we're divisive and we allow the messaging of being divided and that there's no place for certain groups or that toxic culture, you know, stuff that comes out through podcasts or whatever, we have to figure out a way to combat it. And it's just, it seems overwhelming at this moment because there is no strong journalism anymore. And, you know, how people consume news and media is so different. And we're just going to have to figure it out.
Before I let you go here, I want to look ahead in this state. And I was talking with previous guests this hour about the shifts in, you know, Republicans are looking at New York City. The five boroughs there went 10 points further to the right in this election. And, you know, and that is true across different racial and ethnic demographics. So the shift rightward even happened in the five boroughs. Republicans are really starting to think about winning in 2026, the governor's office. They're starting to think of a future New York that turns more purple than blue. Are you concerned about that?
I mean, these are obviously we picked up a seat in the assembly. I feel like we can message well when we, you know, particularly in an assembly district, when you can really get to know your community, your district well and make, you know, your case to be the best leader. But I think these are, you know, things that we have to pay attention to and trends that we have to know are happening. Again, you have to figure out why. You have to figure out what people want. I do think this idea of how we can unite instead of divide is a difficult one, but something we as a state are going to have to do and figure out. Even you can say crime stats are going down and that, yeah, everywhere I go, people say they're not. Like, they challenge the data because they just perceive and feel different than what they see or read. And they don't care what they see or read. They care how they feel. And so these are some real challenges that we have, I think, in each community. We have to pay attention to the why, and not just, you know, sort of say things in a monolith that, oh, New York City, it's always blue, it's always deep blue, we'll be fine. We're going to have to go into these communities. I think we've made big roads in the AAPI community and done a lot to elevate voices in New York City there. I think we have to do that through some other groups and folks who live in many of these boroughs and have, you know, really built strong communities there, make sure that we're paying attention and elevating voices and making everybody included in the, you know, the future of where they live. To mention, housing is just so unaffordable right now in New York City. And it overwhelms the ability to even talk about creating a place there where people can, you know, get by anymore. And so that is something that I just think is the elephant in the room.
All right, before I let you go, last question for you. Let me just ask a little bit about what I'm reading in my emails this morning. And the email is far and wide. It is across the spectrum. There's a lot of celebration. There's a lot of commiseration, a lot of confusion. And, I've got plenty from from Dems who say, the national election wasn't about gender. It was about inflation. It was about an unpopular administration. It was about economic messages not resonating. And then I've got plenty from people who are saying, you know, is there a ceiling to what a woman can get in a national election? I wonder how you're feeling about that today. Kamala Harris almost never mentioned her gender. Very different. She ran a very different campaign compared to Hillary Clinton 8 years ago. And I'm sure that was intentional. I'm sure that she did not want this to be about identity politics at all. She wanted to steer away from that. And that didn't seem to matter. And so how are you feeling today?
I do feel that there does seem to be this hard thing on the national level to really, you know, penetrate as a woman leader coming out. I mean, everyone thought if anyone could do it, it was Hillary, right? She had the name recognition, she had the pedigree and the responsibility and the best experience, probably one of the top presidential nominees ever when it comes to experience, and still struggled. There is a part of me as a woman in an elected office who does see it and understand that it's subtle. And I just think there's, she had to be perfect. And yet, you know, we've normalized Trump's ramblings and all his things as just okay. That is something I think we are still struggling with as a nation and a country to really elevate a woman's voice in a way that people are willing to accept and vote for. But I also think, I don't think inflation helped, and I don't think, the process by which she became the nominee was, people had their own thoughts about it. But she had to run. She couldn't really differentiate. I think there were a lot of people that were still questioning why, she let Joe, like she had any power in it at all. But, I think she was sort of held responsible for things people didn't like in the Biden administration, but then didn't also give her credit for the things they liked. And, she was just sort of in a no-win situation.
I want to thank you for making the time. Everyone is wiped out and tired, no matter what side of the political aisle you're on, and not an easy day to jump on the radio. Thank you, Assemblymember.
And my dog would like to join in.
Your dog is always welcome. Assemblymember Clark from District Number 136, going back with a big victory to Albany. Thank you. I know we'll talk again soon.
Thank you, Evan. Have a good one.
That's Assemblymember Sarah Clark. We are, listeners, these 2 hours talking to many of the winners on election night. And in our next conversation, we welcome in a member of the New York State Senate who is going back after another big victory, Samra Brouk in District Number 55. Senator Brouk, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
I'm not to be trite, but I'll ask you what I asked your colleague Sarah Clark. You win a big victory. It always feels good to win. Your party really struggled nationally. You know, there's a lot of emotion there. What's the dominant emotion you're feeling right now?
Oh, it depends on the minute, to be honest. I'm reeling, like I think a lot of people are, trying to make sense of what we're seeing on a national level. And, you know, a big difference for me from the first time we all went through this in 2016 is that I'm now in a position where I also need to be thinking about what I'm going to do to protect the people I represent, right, here in New York, and how do I use my position, you know, as much as possible to allow, you know, New Yorkers to feel safe at the very least. And so I think it's definitely a lot of mixed emotions. We had a short time period last night where we were able to celebrate the Monroe County victories. And I think we were all pleasantly, you know, delighted at some of the things that we saw happening in Monroe County before we all saw the more national news. But yeah, I think it's a minute by minute. I think a lot of people are just kind of taking in a lot of information. And just my innate response is always action. So thinking about immediately, what does this mean and how can I make sure I do my part?
I understand that very well. I mean, certainly elections give information. And so on one hand, the action that already people who are already in office can do to either try to mitigate results or, as you say, protect constituents that you're going to try to undertake. And then there are the lessons that a party has to absorb if it is going to avoid future defeats and learn lessons. And you say that a lot of Democrats are trying to make sense of the national election. What are some of the things that stand out most to you that you say, hey, as a party, if we don't change X, we're going down the wrong road here? What are you learning?
Well, I think, first of all, we're a few hours, right, into just reading some of the results. And so I don't think I have a good sense yet at nationally exactly what needs to happen. But I will look at it through my own lens, which is, you know, how I've been able to successfully run campaigns where we are in upstate New York. And it's always been a very, very ground up strategy, right? It's been very informed by what I hear, what people are telling me. It's a lot of listening involved, right? And that's how I've always formed how I work in these positions. And so, you know, the thing I always think about is all politics is local. Right? I mean, yes. I mean, obviously messaging is important. You know, there's a lot of things that go into political campaigns. And at the end of the day, the conversation you have at someone's door, at the grocery store, wherever it is in some ways the most powerful conversation you're going to have. And obviously I say that as a state legislator, and I'm at the grocery store with my constituents, right? I have the ability to be talking to so many, about literally thousands of them, you know, all the time. And so I know that that's not always relevant, you know, on a national scale, obviously in a presidential race, but that's where the best data you're going to get in terms of what people are thinking about, what's motivating them or not motivating them to do things like voting and who they're voting for. And so I always go back to that, right? I always go back to literally those conversations and those touch points with people. And I think, you know, I heard a lot of people talking about, we're all sitting here scrolling, reading, absorbing as much information as possible, trying to decide, you know, which information is going to be helpful. But at this point, you can't go back on an election. So it's about moving forward. And what do we do?
Well, do you think that your party has suffered on the national level from any cultural overreach? That's one of the themes that I'm hearing a lot of Republicans talking about, feeling like they profited politically over cultural overreach from the left over the last decade. What do you think?
I don't think there's been cultural overreach. What I think we see both locally and nationally is that we, at this point, have, sadly, a large portion of the Republican Party that is simply not based in shared truths or facts that the rest of us are, you know, living within. And I say large portion because I've got a number of colleagues and friends and family members and constituents, right, who do believe in these facts and look at what's actually happening and respond accordingly. But unfortunately, it's been this dominant messaging from that party that, you know, starts with their presidential candidate. And it's fear-mongering. I mean, I know we say that word a lot, but the reason we say it is because it's the most accurate word we can use to describe what we see. And it's feeding into, you know, these made up fears that they create and then really driving them home over and over and over again. And they're incredibly unified in driving that home. And that's really scary because then you have folks who are, you know, potentially voting for someone who will not have their best interests at heart.
Well, and so here's an example of where the political right has been pointing to. First of all, they won, so I'm trying to understand where the winners are coming from. Megyn Kelly on the election eve stood on stage and said that the issue that really activated her the most, that caused her to re-endorse Donald Trump, was trans athletes in girls' sports. And that's not a big population. It's not a big number. But where I'm curious to know if you have moved at all, I want to just read a little bit of a story that came out last year. This was last spring. A transgender cyclist named Austin Killips won a women's race and won it pretty handily. And the woman who came in second place had a lot to say about losing that race and what it meant to lose to a trans athlete. And so the second place finisher said that we have to have grace and love for everybody, all athletes, including trans athletes. And ultimately, there has to be a competition and a space for all athletes, including trans athletes. Now, the woman who came in second said she eventually thinks we should get to a place where trans athletes have their own competitions and that they're not competing in women's sports. But she said for now, that doesn't exist. She is going to salute the winner. And she thinks we need to have more grace, but maybe move to a place of compromise. And I think that's a lot of people saluted that as saying that's a graceful response. It's not extreme in any direction. And yet she was also attacked by some on the left for, well, why are you trashing a trans athlete? Why are you complaining? How do you view that issue? Do you think this is overblown? Do you think it's broken through culturally? And do you think that there is a compromise on that issue?
I think first and foremost, and, you know, this came up as the same challenge we had with Proposition 1 in the state constitutional amendment, where, again, a very, very small section of our population was weaponized and targeted as a reason to not enshrine equal rights for all in our state constitution. I just want to make sure that we all understand that, right? When you think about the fact that this is such a small percentage of our population, in some cases, some of the most endangered individuals in our population, endangered for higher suicide rates, endangered for higher homelessness, especially for youth, right? Mental health struggles. So such a small portion of our population being weaponized and targeted as a means to an end to push other agendas. And we saw that here in New York, and obviously we're proud that it didn't work in New York and that people actually did their homework and read up to realize that the Equal Rights Amendment, Proposition 1, was in everyone's best interest to enshrine equal rights in our state constitution. But that's what we keep seeing, right, is these small populations of people that get weaponized. And unfortunately, this is repeated throughout history. There are always populations of people that when, in some cases, the wrong person identifies them, they can weaponize them. And I'm sitting here saying this as the Black woman who ran for state Senate and became the first Black woman in upstate New York to serve in the state Senate. So I know the history that the same types of fear-mongering, the same types of weaponization were used against people that look like me, and in some places still are. And so, unfortunately, this is a repeating theme in history of identifying a group that is vulnerable, that is often smaller than a majority, in this case, a small, small portion of our country, and using that to fearmonger and using it to blow things out of proportion and to get people to literally vote on things that in some cases have nothing to do with them, but in other ways could actually hurt them. And I think a great example is the Proposition 1, which we know is going to help so many people in New York to have these equal rights enshrined. And that's what I see when I hear that.
Last minute, there have been times where Republicans wake up, they've had a bad day, they feel dispirited. Today is a day a lot of Democrats across the country are waking up and wondering what happened, or even saying, you know, I feel like I got to quit. Like I can't believe that where we are. What is your message to people in your party who feel like they've reached the end of their line here?
My message is, first of all, look at home first. I said all politics is local. We sent a mandate for some of our Dems here in Monroe County, most of them, in fact. We sent a mandate, you all did, as voters, sent the mandate to say, keep doing the work that you're doing. We appreciate your responsiveness, your accessibility, and what you're doing to help support our community. So start with that. There are local wins, and those wins are wins for people, right? That means voters going and saying, this is what I want. I need this elected to be there to pass the laws that will protect me and support my family and my children. So first of all, remember those. And I'm trying to find moments in my day to remember this, you know, great win. But the second is, I go back to history. Look at what we have gone through historically. Look at the mechanisms and strategies we have employed to get as far as we have gotten. No one promises that we're going to have every win. No one promises that it's all going to be easy. So that's what I would give folks.
Senator Brooke, thank you for always being generous with your time. And we look forward to the next conversation. We'll probably do it in studio here. There's a lot to talk about that I know you're working on. Thank you again.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Big victory for State Senator Somra Brooke. She was one of many incumbents in New York state politics in our region who did very well. In fact, Democrats like Senator Brooke really outperformed some of the national trends, and so we're exploring some of that. We're going to talk to Congressman Joe Morelli at the top of the next hour. We're going to talk to a couple members of the New York State Assembly. It's all still coming up on Connections.